and when she kissed Walter goodbye, she promised to come back soon. She wanted to see him again, and didn't want to wait too long at his age.
"He loved meeting you," her cousin Tom told her before she left. He didn't tell her how resistant Walter had been before she had arrived, and how she had totally captivated him. He was her biggest fan by the end of her stay. He had come alive again talking to her.
"I'm sorry you didn't know him when he was younger. He was a terrific guy."
"He still is," she assured him, and they all hugged each other and promised to stay in touch. She thanked them for everything, and as she drove back to the airport in L.A., she was so happy she'd come to meet them. It had been one of the most important weekends of her life. She had a real family now, one where she was welcome and belonged. She could hardly wait to see them all again.
Chapter 19. The results of the DNA test came at the end of April, and were no surprise. Marguerite Wallace Pearson de Sanpignelli was Valerie's mother. Valerie hadn't doubted it, but hearing it was like an affirmation of who she was, and gave her back the identity that had been stolen from her at birth. She called Winnie after they told her, just to let her know, and Winnie sounded shaken and tearful.
"I know it's stupid," she said, sniffing, "but I feel like I just lost the only sister I had."
"I can be as big a pain in the ass as your niece as I was as your sister. And I don't care what you call me. Nothing's changed." But a lot had changed, and they both knew it. Valerie had gained an important piece of her history, a part she had never even known was lost. In spite of her mother's coldness to her, she had been a happy person, and had made peace with not being loved as a child, and had overcome it, in great part thanks to Lawrence. But the lack of love she'd endured as a child was unnatural, and now she knew she had been deeply loved by her real mother. It completed her, and added a part of her that she hadn't known was missing. It filled her with a profound and satisfying sense of peace. It was like coming home after a long journey. She wasn't an outcast anymore, or a misfit. She had had a real mother and father, and knew who they were, even if they were no longer alive. For some strange reason, it gave her more confidence in herself. And it made Winnie feel more vulnerable somehow, and more alone. She was the only one left of her generation, even if she and Valerie were only 4 years apart. And all their parents' lies had been exposed, in spite of Winnie's futile attempts to protect them. Penny called Valerie after the results came in and said that there would be a hearing in surrogate's court to confirm that Marguerite was her mother and Valerie was her heir. She said that she would have to pay inheritance taxes on the value of the jewelry and had 9 months to pay it. She was going to use the proceeds from the Christie's auction to pay the taxes and keep the rest. Penny asked her if she still wanted to sell the jewelry now that she knew for certain that Marguerite was her mother, and Valerie discussed it with Philip. She said that she couldn't imagine wearing any of it, although it was spectacularly beautiful, but it was all much too showy for her. She preferred to sell it and invest the money wisely, and let someone else enjoy the jewelry, which wasn't suited to her life. All she wanted to keep was the box with her mother's crest ring, the locket with her baby picture in it, and the wedding ring from Umberto. She wanted to sell the rest. Penny had her mother sign a release that she wished to make no claim on the estate, and that would be filed with the surrogate's court as well. And Philip notified Christie's that the Pignelli jewels were no longer being sold to benefit the state, but a rightful heir had been located, and the sale would proceed as planned. They were going to add an insert to the catalog, notifying buyers of the change. It made no difference to them, but it was a technicality they had to observe. The hearing in surrogate's court was set for 2 weeks before the auction. Penny would be there, and Philip with Valerie. Harriet would be the clerk for the case, and Jane had promised to come, although she would be leaving her position as clerk at the court 2 weeks before the hearing to finish her classes at Columbia. And she was already busily preparing for graduation. Her parents were flying to New York for it, and she wanted Philip to meet them. And after the results of the DNA test came in, Philip invited Jane to dinner to meet his mother. They had been dating for 6 weeks by then, and were seeing a lot of each other, almost every night. It wasn't by any particular plan or agreement, it just seemed to work out that way, and they went sailing every weekend, and Sweet Sally was not a wedge between them, but a bond, and something they enjoyed doing together. Philip invited both women to dinner at La Grenouille.
He wanted it to be special and festive, and to make it a celebratory evening when his mother met Jane. He didn't admit it to either woman, but he was nervous about it. What if they hated each other, or considered each other rivals for his attention? Anything was possible, and he thought women were unpredictable that way, and just when you wanted them to like each other, they didn't. Even Valerie, who was normally sensible. She had always preferred the women he liked least, and disliked the ones he was crazy about, although there hadn't been many of those, and Valerie usually had valid reasons for her opinions, and proved to be right in the end. So the evening was important to him. He picked Valerie up at her home, and Jane met them at the restaurant, feeling slightly daunted by the elegant surroundings and the fact that she was meeting his mother, which scared her. She wasn't sure what to expect from his description, and she knew how close they were and how much he respected what she thought. Jane felt shy at first, but Valerie made an effort to put her at ease, and by the end of the first course, the two women were getting along famously, and Valerie told them about her visit to the Babcocks in Santa Barbara and how much fun it had been. And they talked about Jane's plans after graduation and when she passed the bar exam. The evening sped by, and afterward they dropped Valerie off at home. Philip walked her into the building, and she gave him an emphatic thumbs up. By the time they got back to Jane's apartment, Philip was exhausted and realized that he had been tense all night, wanting it to go well.
"I love her,"
Jane said enthusiastically as Philip collapsed on her IKEA couch. He had enjoyed the dinner, but there had been a knot in his stomach all night, hoping for the best and fearing the worst.
"She's like talking to someone our age, only better,"
Jane said, and he laughed. It was an apt description of his mother. "She's very lively and youthful. I forget how old she is sometimes, and she certainly didn't look anything close to her age."
"If I'd met her without you, I'd still want to be friends with her," Jane explained. "She's such a real person."
"I feel that way, too," he confessed. "I'd like her even if she weren't my mother." It was a high compliment from a man his age.
"She doesn't seem possessive. I thought she'd hate me."
"She loved you," he reassured her. It had been a perfect evening for all three of them, and a superb dinner. And the sommelier had chosen excellent wines for them.
"At least that's behind us. You've met her. Now that's done," he said, looking relieved, and Jane laughed at him.
"You look like you went over Niagara Falls in a barrel tonight."
"I think I did. I never know how women are going to react to each other, especially my mother." But she had been easy and fun, and great company, and she and Jane had enjoyed several good laughs at his expense, particularly about his passion for his boat. They talked for a while longer, and then went to bed. He'd been staying at her apartment a lot lately. She had mentioned it to Alex, who had been impressed, and had referred to him as a keeper. Jane was beginning to think so, too, although it was early days yet. They were still in the honeymoon phase, but it was showing no sign of abating. Things just kept getting better and better. He wrapped his arms around her when they went to bed, and he'd been so stressed all night that instead of making love to her, as he usually did, he mumbled a few words, hugged her closer, and fell asleep as Jane lay smiling next to him. Even without making love, it had been a very good night. And if she had passed muster with his mother, as he said, it had been a great one. The day of the confirmation hearing of Valerie as Marguerite's daughter and sole heir, it was pouring rain. She and Philip arrived in a cab. Penny got there a few minutes later, looking drenched, and Jane shortly after. Winnie came, as a gesture of respect for her newly discovered niece, although she had no part in the proceedings. And Harriet Fine was there with all the records and files and evidence to present to the court. She was pleased to see Jane, and realized for the first time that something was going on between Philip and Jane.
"So that's the way it is,"
she said with a wry smile, and Jane blushed. But she was no longer clerking there, and she had left Harriet on good terms. And Harriet was in a much better mood than she had been in for a while. Her mother was doing better, and was staying with her again. She knew it wouldn't last forever, but for now things had improved, and she was happy to have her home. The confirmation hearing was brief and perfunctory. Harriet presented the file to the court. Penny represented Valerie, who solemnly swore that all the evidence and her statements were true and correct, and she was in fact Marguerite de Sanpignelli's heir. Winnie cried when the judge confirmed it, and Valerie was beaming afterward.
Now you get to pay taxes on the estate, Winnie said to her smugly.
I know, Valerie smiled at her. The auction will take care of that. Valerie was sorry to see all the beautiful pieces go, but it made no sense for her to keep them. Philip had already brought her the small box with the gold pieces, and Valerie was wearing the crest ring in the locket. She had put her mother's gold wedding band away. And as they left the court, Winnie commented to her that she should use some of the money to buy a decent apartment and finally move out of the one she'd lived in for years.
I love my apartment, Valerie said, shocked. Why would I move?
You could have more space, a bigger studio, better furniture, and a nicer neighborhood.
Winnie had never liked Soho and thought they were all crazy to live downtown. Valerie in Soho, Philip in Chelsea, her daughter in the West Village. It suited them, but Winnie couldn't understand it. None of them would have wanted to live on Park Avenue uptown as she did. It was too far from the places they liked to go to and the things they wanted to do. But Winnie was from another era, and Valerie was one of them, and had lived downtown far longer than any of the others.
I guess you'll always be a bohemian, Winnie said ruefully, and Valerie laughed.
I hope so.
They were in good spirits as they left the building. They all had to go back to work, and school in Jane's case, and Valerie went to make some arrangements she'd been planning for weeks. And that night she called Fiona and told her the results of the DNA test, and about the hearing that day. Fiona was happy for her. Things were working out as they should have. She was just sorry it had taken so many years.
If you hadn't told me the truth when I came to see you, none of this would have happened, she said gratefully.
I should have done it years ago,
Fiona said seriously,
instead of waiting for you to come and ask me.
She sounded tired on the phone, but relieved. She said her daughter had been to see her that day. Her children were good to her, and Valerie was pleased to hear it. And then Valerie told her what she was planning. She hadn't told anyone else yet, and Fiona approved. They both agreed it was the right thing to do.
You have your mother back now, Fiona said gently, and no one can take her away from you again. I'm sure she's watching over you, and she'd be very proud of you. She always was,
Fiona said softly.
I love you, Fiona,
Valerie said when they hung up. And Fiona loved her, too. In the end, Fiona had returned her mother to her. It was her final gift to both Valerie and Marguerite. Chapter 20 On the weekend before the Christie's sale, Philip and Jane went sailing on Saturday. It was a beautiful May day, and the following day was Mother's Day. He was planning to spend the day with Valerie, and she had finally shared her plans with him. She had bought a good-sized plot at a beautiful, peaceful cemetery on Long Island, had it landscaped, and had made arrangements to move Marguerite and bury her there. She had visited Marguerite in the crowded, dreary cemetery where she was buried after Fiona had told Valerie her story, and she wanted to honor her mother with a better final resting place. It was a small thing she could do for her, a final gesture of love and respect. She had told Philip he could bring Jane along to the brief graveside service. Winnie was coming, with Penny, and afterward they were going to lunch, although Penny was going back to her husband and kids for Mother's Day and not joining them for lunch. Philip and Jane were sailing in gentle winds on Saturday when he told her he had to go to Hong Kong in September to participate in a sale of important jades, and he asked her if she wanted to come along. His trips to Hong Kong were always interesting and fun.
If I'm not working yet, she said practically, if I am, I probably can't get away.
He loved going to Hong Kong for the jade sales and would have liked to go with her.
I'll keep it in mind, she promised.
She had two interviews scheduled in the coming week and one the week after, and then it would be graduation. She was already deep in her review for the bar exam, and hoped she passed it on the first try, which wasn't always the case, but it would be embarrassing not to. Philip had been impressed by how much she studied and how hard she worked, although it was cutting into their time together, but he knew it wouldn't be forever. She was taking the bar exam in July, and after that, he hoped to take her on vacation. They'd been talking about going sailing in Maine, which sounded wonderful to both of them. She was the first woman he'd ever known who thought so. The service that Valerie had organized on Mother's Day for her mother was short,
poignant and respectful. It paid homage to the mother she would have been, if she'd had the chance. Valerie had bought a large plot, with two big trees on it, and the white marble headstone said, "Beloved Mother," and then Marguerite's name and the dates just beneath it. She'd asked a minister to say a brief service, and Valerie stood for a long moment at her mother's gravesite, wishing her peace, and then they all left the cemetery together. Penny drove back to her family in the city, and the others went to lunch at a nearby restaurant with a cheerful garden. And afterward, they went back to the city, too. Valerie felt as though they had closed another chapter as they drove home, and the four of them talked about the upcoming sale. Philip had said there was enormous interest in it, and he was expecting some very high bids on the phones. Some of their most important jewelry clients had already placed absentee bids. Marguerite's collection of beautiful pieces had already created quite a stir, and the section of the catalog dedicated to her was impressive, discreet, and elegant. The caption above it said, "Property of a noble woman," as Philip had suggested, and she had agreed. Philip had very properly advised Christie's of his relationship to Marguerite once he discovered he was her grandson, and they had decided to allow him to work at the sale anyway, although he wouldn't be the auctioneer. He would be taking phone bids. Valerie had invited Jane to go to the auction with her. The anticipation was mounting, and with her mother respectfully acknowledged and buried now, Valerie was ready to move on. The night of the auction, Valerie arrived a few minutes early at the main auction room with enormously high ceilings and neat rows of chairs. Philip had reserved a seat for her in the second row, on the aisle, and she could observe the auctioneer at the podium and the long bank of phones easily from where she sat. She had worn a plain black dress and her mother's small locket and gold ring. The men who worked for Christie's were all wearing dark suits and ties. The female employees were wearing black suits or proper dresses, and the women in the audience in the bidder seats were expensively dressed and wearing jewels. It was a very elite group. There were also several well-known jewelers in the audience. The cream of New York was there, with an equal mix of European buyers, jewelers, and celebrities. Marguerite's pieces were the most important in the sale, and people were perusing the catalog, with the photographs of Marguerite and Umberto looking glamorous, interspersed with the photographs of the jewels. Christie's had done it just right to enhance public interest and keep the aura of mystique about her, without cheapening it with sensationalism or anything vulgar. It was top-notch, and no one had suspected an event like this when Jane called Philip for an appraisal and he appeared at the bank to view the contents of the safe deposit box. Jane got there seconds before the sale began and took her seat next to Valerie with an apology for being late. She was afraid it might have already started, but it hadn't. She was wearing a pale blue silk suit the color of her eyes and looked very pretty as Valerie, with her white hair in a French twist, smiled at her, quiet and distinguished. She felt as though they were paying homage to her mother that night, and in a way they were. She felt a flutter in her stomach, wondering if the sale would do well. It was hard to imagine that it wouldn't, after the care Christie's had taken. And she was partly sad, too, to be parting with items that had obviously been important to her mother, and that she had held on to for so long, but it made no sense to keep them. They weren't appropriate for Valerie's life, even if they had been to her mother's, more than half a century before, in another world. She wondered who would buy them and cherish them as Marguerite had. Each one had been a gift of love from the man she had married. Valerie patted Jane's hand with a smile as the auctioneer stood at the podium but hadn't started yet. Valerie glanced at Philip then, who smiled at his mother, wishing he could sit with her too, to lend his support. Valerie had invited Winnie, but she said that the excitement of the bidding would make her nervous and give her palpitations. She preferred to hear about it the next day and learn the final results. It was so like Winnie not to be there, and Valerie wondered if it saddened her too to see her sister's possessions disappear. She had never known the sister who had supposedly died. Her story had turned out to be completely different from the one they were told. But Marguerite was her sister, and Winnie had lost her too. Tom and Angie Babcock had called Valerie the night before the sale to wish her luck. She had sent them a catalog, and Tom had shown it to Walter. Angie said he had nodded and looked at each photograph carefully, and he had said that she had grown up to be even more beautiful than she was as a young girl. He realized then that she had married, but Tom said he wasn't upset by it. He had expected her to. She was a very pretty young woman. He was sorry life hadn't worked out better for her, and she'd lost her little girl. It was odd how things happened sometimes, and for his brother Tommy, too. Valerie couldn't help wondering what their life would have been like, or hers, if their parents had let them marry. Marguerite would have been widowed almost immediately, but at least their secret would have been out in the open, and she would have stayed in New York with her daughter. Valerie's life would have been completely different with her real mother, and her childhood happier. But tonight was not about Marguerite and Tommy. It was about her and the Count, who had showered her with jewels and a golden life for more than 2 decades. The auctioneer was a tall, serious man with a deep, booming voice who was well known to their important clients, and Christie's knew he would handle the auction well. The bidding began at exactly 7:15. The first lot in Marguerite's collection was number 156, which Philip had said would take about 2 hours to get to, so they had time. They had 155 lots to sell before hers, which went through lot 177. And there were only a dozen lots being sold after hers, mostly loose stones, and 2 very important diamond rings, which were expected to go for over $1 million each. Marguerite's jewelry was in good company that night. Valerie followed the bidding closely, whispering to Jane from time to time about some particularly impressive or beautiful item. Jane had noticed and commented to her in a whisper that the better pieces were going for about 4 times the estimate, and 1 or 2 went for 6 times the estimate, which was good for both the sellers and the house. The estimates on Marguerite's pieces had been set high, with strong reserves, which meant that they could not be sold for less than a certain amount, to preclude their being sold for below their value. The estimates had been the subject of considerable discussion, determined by the makers and the size and value of the stones, all of which were of top quality and sizes that were almost impossible to find nowadays. The pieces in her collection were extremely rare now, more so than Marguerite ever knew or could have hoped when she kept them. If she had sold even 1 or 2, she could have been more comfortable at the end of her life, which tugged at her daughter's heart, knowing that she had been preserving them for her. The earlier items in the auction sold 1 by 1, and the auctioneer's voice droned on. There were a couple of bidding wars, one notably between a well-known jeweler and a private buyer who simply refused to lose the piece. The jeweler dropped out after driving the price up, and the private buyer paid 10 times the estimate for it, but seemed thrilled. And then finally they were at lot 155 at 9:35, and Valerie took a deep breath as the hammer fell for a sapphire cocktail ring by Harry Winston that went for $300,000, just over the estimate, but within range. It was purchased by a jeweler who would sell it for twice that on Madison Avenue. And they were up next. Jane squeezed her hand as the simple Van Cleef diamond pin came up first. 2 women held up their paddles with their bidding numbers immediately. As Jane had already noticed, the major jewelers who were known to Christie's held up no paddle, but made subtle, nearly invisible gestures to signify their bids, and the auctioneer knew their bidding numbers by heart. But the privates used the paddles, with rare exceptions. A few of the celebrities in the audience didn't use the paddles either. Everyone knew who they were. You had to look closely to see who was in the race, and the jewelers tended to let the privates get in a frenzy first, and then stepped in. 3 other bidders joined them for the diamond pin, as Valerie and Jane watched, fascinated. Some of the bidders were clearly jewelers, but one of the women refused to let go, and at the very end the man sitting next to her, presumably her spouse, discreetly put up a hand. The auctioneer saw it and nodded. The man's bid was prevailing, and then, just before the hammer went down, one of the jewelers jumped in again, and the woman who had wanted the piece looked crestfallen, and her husband bid again with a determined expression. And this time the hammer fell, and it was hers. She kissed the man who had bought it for her, and was smiling broadly, as the diamond brooch from Cartier came up next. And all the underbidders from the previous piece leaped in heatedly right from the beginning. Christie's had set the stage well, trying to capitalize on moments such as this. The bidding on the Cartier brooch went faster and higher, and was more furious, and it sold for 2x the price of the Van Cleef piece. Valerie realized then that she was holding her breath, and slowly exhaled as they brought up the next piece. An image of it appeared on a large video screen at the same time. Valerie glanced at Philip, but he was busy on the phones, and had a bank of 3 of them in front of him, so he could keep people on hold at the last minute as they waited for their lots to come up. There was tangible excitement in the room, and the first two pieces were the least exciting of Marguerite's jewels, and had sold extremely well, better even than Philip had expected, and when he glanced over at his mother and their eyes met, he nodded and looked pleased. The Cartier Tiger bracelet was sold next. Philip had explained to her that the bracelets like that one were collector's pieces, and that that particular one hadn't been made by Cartier in 40 years, so it was an important piece for connoisseurs. It was a classic example of Cartier's work. The bidding on it was hot and fast, mostly among jewelers, with some privates, and the hammer fell at just under $1 million to a well-known collector of fine jewelry who lived in Hong Kong. He had bought it for his wife, who already owned many examples of Cartier's tigers. They had been favorites of the Duchess of Windsor, too, and appeared in many books. They moved on to the pearl and diamond choker, then, which wasn't one of Valerie's favorites, but was pretty. Her mother had had such a thin, elegant neck that it had been too small for Valerie when she tried it on. It was very much of a bygone era, but had an antique elegance to it, and it became the object of a bidding duel between two well-known jewelers who sold antique jewelry at enormous prices and could ask anything they wanted. It went for the high estimate, which was a respectable amount for the piece. Marguerite's Boucheron pieces sold after that, and went for good, solid prices to individuals who liked them more for the design than for the value of the stones, which were handsome nonetheless, and they brought a good price as well. They went back to Van Cleef, then, with the invisibly set sapphire necklace and earrings. Philip had predicted it would go high. It was an exceptionally fine example of their famous invisible setting technique, and the necklace was large and flattering on the neck. It went for close to $1 million, as Valerie watched in fascination. Jane never took her eyes off the podium and the auctioneer, mesmerized by the action. You had to look around the room carefully to see who was bidding. Some of the bids were very subtle, with a nod, a facial expression, a single finger, or a barely raised hand. The long strand of natural pearls came up next, and was again hotly battled over by connoisseurs who knew the value of pearls of that size and quality, of a kind that was no longer available in the modern world. Valerie nearly fell out of her seat when they went for $2.5 million, which Philip had told her they might. He was smiling broadly. They had gone to one of his clients on the phone, who was thrilled. She was calling from London. She had stayed up till after 3 in the morning to bid on them over the phone. But she was successful and delighted, which made it all worthwhile. The remaining Van Cleef items came up after that, a sapphire ring and bracelet, which sold for top prices to jewelers who knew they had a market for them, one in Los Angeles and the other from Palm Beach. They were well known to Christie's, and the auctioneer recognized them immediately. They moved on to Marguerite's Italian pieces then, two from Bulgari that sold at very high prices, and some others from unknown jewelers who no longer existed. But the pieces were pretty and did well. The emerald and diamond bracelet from that group was the most impressive and sold for $500,000 to an unknown buyer no one recognized, and the diamond bracelet that looked like lace doubled the high estimate and sold to an Italian buyer on the phone, who was not a client of Philip's, but whom Christie's knew well. Most of their buyers in this rarefied category preferred pieces by big-name jewelers, which were also a good investment, but sometimes the lesser-known pieces surprised everyone if someone fell in love with them. The bidding was taking more time than usual because there was so much competition in the room, so much interest, and so many buyers on the phones. By 10:45, there were 5 pieces left, the antique French diamond tiara and the 4 important rings from Cartier, which were the big events in the sale. The auctioneer began with the tiara, which sold to an antique dealer in Paris. The 30-carat emerald ring was the first of the final group, and you could feel the electricity in the room. Without thinking about it, Valerie took Jane's hand in her own and held tight. She was about to watch the last of her mother's only possessions dispersed, but for a vast fortune she would one day leave to her son as a final blessing from her mother. The bidding started slow and high. The auctioneer opened at $500,000, and it was double that within minutes, and then double again, and then it moved up in $100,000 increments. The hammer came down at $3 million, and there was a gasp in the room. It was the highest price obtained at Christie's recently for an emerald of that size, but it was clearly worth it. It was purchased by a private buyer from Dubai, a handsome Arab man with 3 beautiful wives, and he was generous with them. One of them had fallen in love with the emerald ring. The 25-carat ruby ring was next, with its astounding deep color, and it sold very quickly to another private buyer for $5 million. Philip wasn't surprised. The successful bidder was also well known to them, though not one of his clients. The jewelers had stopped bidding on the final lots because the privates were willing to go too high to make it worthwhile for them to resell. They were letting the important rings go, which were the cream of the sale. The 40-carat, emerald-cut white diamond ring looked spectacular on the video screen when the image came up. It was D-color, the best and purest color there was, and internally flawless, which would drive the price up even further. The bidding was strong and moved in $100,000 increments rapidly to the price of $9 million, sat there for a minute as the auctioneer scoured the room and checked with the Christie's representatives on the phones. Just as he was about to drop the hammer, it went to 10, with an $11 million bid on the phone instantaneously, and a final bid brought it to $12 million, and it stayed there. The hammer dropped, and there was a sigh in the room, as though relieved that it was over. It had been Valerie's favorite piece, along with the ruby ring, but it was out of the question that she would keep it. She had nowhere to wear it in the life she led. She preferred to invest the money for her son to inherit one day. And purchasers had to pay an additional 20% to the house for their commission for items under $1 million, and 12% if over $1 million, which added another $1,444,000 to the final price, which actually brought the large white diamond to $13.5 million, which was almost unthinkable. The 56-carat yellow diamond ring was the last piece. Valerie had a death grip on Jane's hand by then, and didn't even know it. The color was categorized as fancy intense, the designation for yellow diamonds, and it was internally flawless as well. It became a battle between two privates, and at the last second, Lawrence Graff, the legendary London jeweler, stepped in and swept it up for $14 million with a stony, deadpan expression that gave nothing away as to whether he thought he got it for a good price or not. But he was brilliant at purchasing the best stones in the world, and he clearly knew he could get more for it set in his own design and with his name attached. With the buyer's commission added, he had paid well over $15 million, almost $16 million. With the sale of the yellow diamond, the disposal of Marguerite's jewels was over. They had brought a total of $41 million. Philip had predicted they would bring between 20 and 30, but Christie's had handled the sale so elegantly that they had done even better than anticipated, particularly with the buyer's commissions added. The house had done well, and so had Valerie, as the owner of her mother's estate. They would have to pay the auction house the 10% seller's commission, which was $4,100,000 of the hammer prices, which meant they had gotten almost $37 million from the sale. She had to pay inheritance taxes on the estate now, which would be $18.5 million, which left her with $18 million to invest, which would benefit Philip one day. But there was far more involved in this sale than money, although that was certainly a factor. The sale had been deeply emotional for her, and she was grateful to her mother for keeping what she had to the very end, even in hard times. She had given her daughter the security and comfort for her later years that Marguerite had never had herself, and had unknowingly included her grandson in the blessing. The lots after Marguerite's in the auction sold very quickly. The loose stones, all colored diamonds, went to Lawrence Graff again. Two pink diamonds were noteworthy, and a pale blue one, and the two important diamond rings at the end of the sale went to private buyers for far less than Marguerite's white and yellow diamonds, which had been the star items in the sale. The sale ended 20 minutes after the last of Marguerite's pieces sold. It was 11:30, and the auction had gone on for 4.5 very intense hours. Valerie stood up, looking as though she'd been dragged by a rope, and was exhausted. It had been incredibly stressful, but well worth it. She didn't look unhappy about what they'd given up, but relieved over what they'd gained. It was an enormous windfall for her, and ultimately, Philip. She hugged him as soon as he left the bank of phones and joined them. Valerie had been talking to Jane, who was bowled over by what she'd seen, the beautiful pieces, the fascinating buyers, the excitement and tension in the room. It had been like an action-packed thriller all night.
"I felt like I was in a movie," Valerie said in a shaken voice. It had been particularly hard for her, wondering what would happen.
At one point she had fantasized that nothing would sell, which Philip told her could never happen with items like these. But she had never fully understood their enormous value. It was almost impossible to conceive of for the average person. And it was all new to Jane, too, who stood close to Valerie, feeling just as stunned as Philip hugged them both. Only the heads of Christie's, the head of the jewelry department, and the court had known that he was indirectly one of the beneficiaries of the estate.
"We did great," he said to his mother. "Better than the high estimates."
And the reserves they had put on them had never come into play. They had sailed right past them in each case.
"Let's go celebrate,"
Philip said to both women, although he was tired too. It had been a long night, and working on the phones with high bidders, he had to pay close attention that he didn't miss their bids, misplace them, misinterpret what they'd said, or misunderstand them, despite sometimes heavy accents or poor English. The calls were recorded for review later, in case of a dispute, which sometimes happened. There were large amounts of money involved, and people didn't take it lightly if they missed out on a piece they wanted due to the incompetence of the person bidding for them. Philip had had his senses, especially his hearing, finely tuned all night, and he was pleased for his clients who had been successful, and above all, for his mother. In a way, this would be a form of closure for her, and she could move on, with all she knew of her mother now and how loved she had been. It changed everything for Valerie, even more than the sale. Philip suggested that they go to the Sherry Netherland for a drink, and he shepherded them out of the building after he told his colleagues he was leaving. And as they followed him, Valerie looked like she was in shock, and Jane was dazed.
"I don't know how you can say auctioning off jewelry is boring," his mother said in the car. "I had my heart in my mouth all night. I think Winnie would have had a stroke and dropped dead."
They laughed at what she said.
"I have to admit, tonight was anything but boring. But this was a very special sale. The items were incredible, thanks to your mother. And it was meaningful for me because of you. But most auctions aren't like this," he said, smiling at her. "Tonight was incredibly exciting, but this kind of sale happens once in a blue moon, or once in a lifetime. Some of the big art sales are like this, too. But I have to admit," he smiled at her, and then at Jane, "I really enjoyed this one. Who wouldn't?"
And the results had been better than even he had dreamed, especially for his mother, who was set till the end of her days, as was he now, if they invested the money well. She had wanted to call Winnie and tell her about it, but it had been too late by the time they were through. By then, Valerie knew she was asleep. They stayed at the bar at the Sherry Netherland until 2 o'clock in the morning, trying to wind down and talking about every aspect of the auction. Valerie was still exhilarated when they dropped her off at her apartment, and Philip and Jane went back to his. Valerie had the feeling they were together all the time now, and on his boat every weekend, although she didn't ask. Jane had another month of classes, and then graduation. She had invited Valerie to attend, and said she wanted her to meet her parents. Valerie had promised to come, and was beginning to suspect it was serious between them, although they'd only been dating for 2 months. But she was exactly what Philip needed, and his mother hoped he was smart enough to know it. Jane was good for him, and he seemed happy, but he was a grown man and had to do what he wanted and suited him. And now Valerie was going to do the same. She had promised herself she would go to Europe for at least a month, or even two. She wanted to see where her mother had lived in Rome after Umberto died, before she came back to the States, and also visit the chateau in Naples where they had lived together. It was going to be a kind of pilgrimage for her, and she wanted to float around Florence, maybe Venice, or wherever the spirit moved her to go. She could do anything she wanted now, for the rest of her life, thanks to Marguerite. Valerie fell asleep that night, thinking about the auction. What a dazzling night it had been.
Chapter 21 Valerie spent the next few weeks planning her trip, and just trying to adjust to everything that had happened. Sometimes it was hard to believe it was real. She went back to visit Fiona once, to thank her, and the old nanny seemed sleepy and more tired than she'd been before, although she was just as clear-headed. Everything Fiona had told her in their previous visit had changed Valerie's life forever. It was strange at her age, but Valerie felt more confident now, and no longer apologetic for how different she had been all her life from the people she was related to. Angie and Tom had sent her an email, congratulating her on the successful sale. They had read about it, and thought the results were wonderful. They were happy for her, and were begging her to visit them again, and they were thinking of coming to New York for a long weekend in the fall.
They said Walter was doing well, although little by little he was slowing down, and had had some minor health problems lately that he'd never had before. At 94, it was to be expected, but at least he was happy, well cared for, and comfortable. Jane finished her final paper, after giving up 2 weekends on the boat to do so. And as she'd promised her she would, in June, Valerie attended Jane's law school graduation and met her parents. They all had a lot to talk about. Jane's parents were nice people, and more sophisticated than Valerie had expected. They went to Chicago frequently to see every play, opera, symphony, and ballet that came through there, and went to Europe once or twice a year. Jane's mother had been a psychologist before she married, and was still an avid skier who skied the French Alps every year, and went helicopter skiing in Canada, which was arduous. She was a very attractive, still young woman with a lot of energy and many interests. Jane's father was the CEO of a major insurance company, and an intelligent, interesting, handsome man. They were crazy about Philip when they met him, and enjoyed meeting Valerie. Jane's mother confided to her how worried she was about Jane not wanting to settle down and, according to her mother, being too dedicated to her career. As an only child, they were more focused on her, which Valerie understood.
"It's tough sitting on the sidelines once they grow up," Vivian Willoughby said to Valerie. She was an attractive blonde with a terrific figure and looked a lot like her daughter. She was in her early 50s but seemed 10 years younger than she was, and so did her husband, Hank. He was fit and athletic, and had the chiseled, tanned face of a sailor from being on his boat every weekend in all weather. He was a very attractive man, and they all had a good time. Valerie had enjoyed meeting them. Jane had graduated cum laude. She had 3 interviews with law firms that week. One of them, by sheer coincidence, was Penny's firm. Philip was very proud of Jane, too, and had put a good word in for her with Penny, just in case it helped. She still had to take the bar exam in July, although Philip was certain she would pass it. Jane wasn't as sure.
"We wanted her to come back to Detroit," Vivian confided to Valerie as they stood around after the graduation ceremony. Jane looked very official in her cap and gown. "Or at least Chicago, but she loves it here. And I guess if she gets a good job in New York, or if she and Philip get serious, she'll never come back."
She looked wistful, but resigned about it.
"It's not easy having an only child. You put all your eggs in one basket." "I know. Philip is an only child, too."
Valerie smiled.
"So is my niece. Her mother still worries about her, too. And my niece is 45, happily married, has 3 kids, and is a partner in a law firm. There are kids forever, no matter how old they are."
Valerie was far more relaxed than Vivian, and very open-minded about whatever her son did. Jane's mother was more intense, although Jane seemed normal and sane in spite of it. The Willoughbys had invited everyone to lunch at the Carlisle, Philip and his mother, and Alex, who had attended the graduation, too. And they spent a pleasant afternoon celebrating Jane's successful completion of law school. Looking back, it seemed easy to her now, but it had been brutal along the way. She knew John had graduated from business school the day before. She hadn't heard from him since the day she moved out. She wondered if he was going to L.A. with Kara now. She didn't miss him, and she was having fun with Philip, but it felt strange to her that she no longer had any contact with a man she'd lived with for almost 3 years. It had worked out for the best, and her mother told her how much she liked Philip and his mother after lunch, when they had both left.
"He's a lovely man," Jane's mother commented, "and his mother is a fireball. She said she's leaving for Europe and planning to tour around Italy on her own, and having an art show of her work when she gets back. She's going to visit friends or relatives in California. She said something about possibly taking a class at the Louvre in November, and she's on the board of the Costume Institute at the Met. I couldn't keep up with what she was saying. She made me feel like a slug," Vivian said, sounding admiring and overwhelmed. They knew about the recent auction, and were impressed by that, too.
"Me, too," Jane laughed about Valerie, and there had been all the excitement and stress of her finding out about Marguerite, dealing with the surrogate's court, DNA tests, and the auction. Valerie had never slowed down for a minute. Jane and Philip spent the weekend with her parents. They went to a Broadway play and had dinner at 21.
The women shopped while Philip and Hank went to a boat show and compared newer sailboats to their classic ones and talked sailing and boats for most of the weekend, and even managed to sneak in a brief visit to Philip's boat, and Jane's father loved it. It was all very enjoyable, but Jane was happy when they left. She said entertaining her parents was a lot of work. Making sure they had fun, were doing what they'd planned, and were eating where and when they wanted to, liked the restaurants, and weren't too exhausted. She had loved seeing them, but was happy to kiss them goodbye and go back to her own apartment with Philip and collapse onto her bed for a quiet Sunday night. They wound up making love almost as soon as they lay down, and then later foraged for dinner in the fridge. She was standing naked, eating some leftover chicken, when she asked him what he was doing that week, and he laughed. "Making love to you, I hope, if you're going to stand around like that." She smiled and put the chicken down and wrapped her arms around him. "Best offer I've had," she said, and kissed him. "I'm taking my mother to the airport on Tuesday," he said in a muffled voice as he kissed her neck and held her round, firm bottom in his hands. "Other than that and work, I have no plans. Why?" "I want to study for the bar this week. I thought maybe we could steal the day on Friday and spend 3 days on the boat next weekend. I can bring my books." She was happy to have graduation behind her. She had the interviews for jobs that week, but otherwise her life was slowing down. She had reached a major goal. "Music to my ears," he said, referring to 3 days on Sweet Sally, and then he picked her up and carried her back to bed. It was a perfect Sunday night. Winnie went to see Valerie on Monday afternoon to say goodbye while she was packing. She was almost finished, and they stopped to have iced tea. Winnie had hay fever, as she always did at that time of year, and she looked emotional to see Valerie leave.
"How long will you be gone?" she asked wistfully.
"I don't know. 3 weeks, a month, more, maybe 6 weeks. I just want to float around for a while. It's been a stressful few months."
It was a major understatement. Winnie still felt shaken by everything that had happened, especially learning the truth about her parents, which was still painful for her. She hadn't recovered from that yet, although Valerie looked better than she ever had, and strengthened and validated from what she'd learned.
"I think I like you better as my aunt," she teased Winnie. "It makes me feel young."
And she looked it. Winnie really did seem old enough to be her mother, although they were only 4 years apart.
"Don't say that. I'm still upset that we're not sisters anymore."
There were tears in her eyes as she said it.
"You'll love me as your niece,"
Valerie said, leaned over to kiss her cheek and put an arm around her shoulders. It was easier to make light of the serious situation that had surfaced. Winnie's anger and accusations were forgotten. The two women had made peace, mostly due to Valerie's forgiving nature and happy disposition. And things had turned out well.
"Why don't you meet me in Europe? It would do you good."
"No, it wouldn't. I hate the way you travel. You dash around all over the place. You change plans every 5 minutes. You check in and out of hotels. Ugh, it would put me over the edge. I want to go somewhere and sit and not move. And I don't want to be packing every 5 minutes either."
"Why don't you rent a house in the Hamptons?" Valerie suggested.
"It's too expensive,"
Winnie said sourly.
"I can't afford it."
Valerie gave her a pointed look that said she knew better. Winnie always cried poor.
"Yes, you can, and you know it. You're just too cheap to spend the money,"
she accused her, and Winnie laughed sheepishly.
"That's true," she confessed. "Penny's renting a house in Martha's Vineyard for the summer. She said I could come up for a weekend if I don't nag the kids."
"Could you do that?"
Valerie wasn't sure she could, and neither was Winnie. Her grandchildren drove her crazy, and her daughter, whom she criticized constantly.
"Probably not," Winnie said honestly. "They're just so rude and badly behaved and so noisy, and Penny lets them.
They're just kids, and they're actually pretty good. They don't do anything bad in my studio when they visit,"
Valerie said easily. She liked Penny's kids more than Winnie did.
"You're better with them than I am. I have fun playing cards with them, but other than that, they make me nervous. They move around all the time. I'm always afraid they're going to spill something or break something, and most of the time they do."
Valerie had seen her in action with her grandchildren, and she agreed with Penny. It was nerve-wracking for all involved.
"If they make a mess, you clean it up. You could stay at a hotel at the Vineyard," she suggested.
But Winnie didn't want solutions. She was always married to the problems.
"Why spend the money?"
"Well, you can't sit in your apartment in New York all summer," Valerie said firmly, but she could see that Winnie wasn't convinced.
"Why not?"
"It's depressing. You have to think of somewhere to go or something to do."
"I'm not like you. I'm happy at home by myself."
Their mother had been that way, too. It seemed grim and mournful to Valerie. She wanted to be out and around, meeting new people. She could hardly wait to leave for Europe the next day.
"I'm going to miss you," Winnie said softly. "Call me."
"Of course. I'm starting in Rome to see where my mother lived before she moved back here, and then I'm going to Naples to see the chateau. Philip says it's beautiful, and it's been restored by the current owner. He didn't know my mother, but Philip sent him some photographs of her and the Count at the owner's request. He has a soft spot for them."
Philip had given her Saverio Salvatore's address and phone numbers and told her to look him up so she could see the chateau, and she spoke enough Italian to get by on the phone, more so than Philip, who had struggled with the language when he met him, although they had managed with the gallery owner's fractured English. Philip had noticed that Italian spoke more French than English, and his French wasn't all that great either. His mother's was better.
"Well, don't forget to call me while you're running all over Europe," Winnie reminded her.
"I won't."
Penny had just finished settling the estate for her, and Valerie had paid the inheritance taxes from the proceeds of the sale. She felt free as a bird.
"And I want to hear that you're doing more than just sitting home and playing bridge. I have a tournament this summer."
Winnie brightened at the prospect.
"Good. Do something else, too. It's good for your health."
Winnie nodded and was genuinely bereft as they hugged when she left. She felt as though she were losing her best friend now, after losing a sister and learning the truth about Marguerite. She had been mourning her illusions now for months. Everything seemed different. Valerie and Penny had discussed it, and Winnie's daughter had insisted she'd adjust. Valerie wasn't as sure. Winnie had fought hard all her life to defend their parents and never criticized them or questioned what they did. She had trusted them completely. Having the blinders torn off her eyes to face reality had been hard on her, and Valerie thought she was depressed. Winnie just wasn't a happy person, and now less so than ever. But at least they had made peace after their raging battles over Winnie's parents. Winnie was still inclined to make excuses for them to her daughter, but she didn't dare say a word in their defense to Valerie anymore. She had been proven right in her feelings about them for years. Valerie hoped Winnie would be all right over the summer, and went back to packing after she left. She could hardly wait to leave the next day.
Chapter 22
Philip picked Valerie up at her apartment at 4 o'clock on Tuesday, having left work early to do so. She had 2 good-sized suitcases and a tote bag to take with her on the plane, full of books, magazines, and her iPad. She had to be at the airport at 5, for a 7 p.m. flight to Rome, and she looked like an excited kid when he got to her house and put her bags in the trunk. She chatted animatedly all the way to the airport about her plans to visit museums she'd never been to before in Rome, gallery exhibits in Florence, and the Uffizi, where she'd been countless times and always loved, and the chateau in Naples. And she would see after that, maybe a driving tour in Tuscany, or a stop in Paris on the way home. She planned to be in Italy for most or all of the trip.
"Wait a minute. How long are you going to be gone? 2 years?"
Philip teased her.
"Maybe."
She laughed. She felt carefree and excited about the trip.
"It sounds like it. Don't forget to come back. I'll miss you," he said sincerely.
He was happy to see her so lighthearted since her discoveries about her real mother. Knowing that she had missed an entire lifetime with her had been agonizing. But learning more about her, the life she had led, and the fact that she had hungered for news of her daughter and had been prevented from coming back to her had helped Valerie bond with her, even after her death. Learning how much her mother had loved her made up for her loveless childhood. It had healed an old wound that Valerie never acknowledged but was always there. She had finally freed herself of the disturbing echoes of parents who had never approved of her,
and had been unkind to her all her life. Now she was ready for new adventures, even at 74. When they got to the airport, he helped her check in her bags and get her boarding pass for the flight, and she lingered on the sidewalk with him for a little while before going into the terminal.
"Have a good time with Jane while I'm gone," she told him, looking motherly for a moment, while still trying to respect his freedom of choice as a man. "It was nice meeting her parents. They seemed like good people. I enjoyed them."
Philip did too, to a point. "They get a little intense sometimes," he said quietly. Jane never pressured him, but he sensed that her parents might, especially her mother. She made it clear she would like to see Jane married, a goal Jane didn't care about for now.
"I hope you don't say things like that about me," Valerie said, and he smiled.
"Hardly. You're too busy doing your own thing." He knew all she wanted was for him to be happy, whatever that meant to him. She left how he achieved that, and with whom, up to him.
"I like seeing you with a good woman, and I wouldn't want you to wind up alone, but you can figure out all that for yourself," she said simply, and then added, "Jane is a nice girl."
He smiled as she said it. "Yes, she is. And she's a good sailor, too. And she'll be a good lawyer. She's interviewing with Penny's firm. It would be pretty funny if she winds up working there." Penny and Jane got along well, too. They'd had dinner together several times, and he and Jane were going to spend the weekend with Penny and her family at Martha's Vineyard over the 4th of July. He liked the fact that his mother never pushed him about his personal life. She was too busy with her own. And the way she lived, enjoying her life to the fullest, served as an example to him. It was one of the things he had admired about his parents' marriage. They loved and respected each other, and gave each other space to be who they were. They had never been confining, stifling, or possessive, or tried to change anything about each other. They were tolerant of each other's quirks. It had been a partnership that truly worked. He had seen few other relationships that did, and none of his own. Until now, with Jane. And it meant a lot to him that Jane and his mother liked each other and got along. He could tell that Valerie was anxious to go inside then, and he hugged her and kissed her goodbye, feeling an instant of panic, like a parent sending a child off to camp.
"Take care of yourself, Mom. Be careful. Don't do anything stupid. Naples is full of pickpockets. Watch out when you're there."
He suddenly had 1,000 instructions he wanted to give her, and she laughed.
"I'll be fine. Take care of yourself. You can reach me on my cell or send me an email."
She hugged him again, waved as she left, and disappeared into the terminal, and he felt happy for his mother, after he left her and drove back to the city. He went to Jane's apartment, where she was studying for the bar, as she did constantly now.
"Did your mom get off okay?"
Jane asked when she took a break, and he handed her a glass of white wine. He grinned in answer to her question. She was so happy to leave, it was embarrassing. She loves to travel, and she practically ran into the airport. She can't wait to get to Naples and Rome. It'll be good for her. So much had happened to her recently, and the trip was going to be fun. And at that moment, Valerie was chatting to the person sitting next to her on the plane, selecting a movie, and she had just ordered a meal and a glass of champagne. She was traveling Alitalia, and she had treated herself to business class so she could sleep comfortably on the plane. When she'd mentioned it to Winnie, her now aunt had chided her for the expense. And Valerie had responded that at their age, they could indulge in some luxuries. There was no point saving it till they were 100. She was willing to spoil herself a little now, particularly after the jewelry sale. She had no intention of squandering it, but knew the trip would be easier and less arduous in business than coach, which seemed reasonable to her, though not to Winnie, who preferred to stay home and save the money entirely, and go nowhere. She watched the movie and enjoyed her dinner of osso buco and pasta with a glass of good Italian red wine, and then she settled down to sleep for what was left of the 7-hour flight. They were arriving at 8 a.m. Roman time, and she hoped to be at the hostler by 10, which would give her a full day in Rome. She had her mother's address on a slip of paper in her purse. She wanted to go there before doing anything else. It was why she had come to Rome. She was planning to visit museums and churches for 2 days, enjoy the city, and walk around. And then she was going to Naples to see the chateau, which was going to be a high point for her, knowing that Marguerite had lived there for more than 30 years. She had lived in the apartment in Rome for 20. Italy had really become her home, although Valerie knew from her letters that her mother had been happier in Naples with Umberto than alone in Rome after he died. Valerie could only guess that her best years had been at the Castello di San Pignelli while he was alive. Her life must have been very lonely after that, with no relatives in the world. Valerie slept lightly on the plane, had a cup of strong coffee before they landed on time, and was among the first off the plane. She took a cab to the Hotel Hostler, and was given a small room similar to Philip's when he was there in March, and she took a cab to her mother's old Roman address as soon as she had showered and changed into a long black cotton skirt, t-shirt, sandals, and a Panama hat. She looked very casual and stylish, with her long, straight white hair streaming down her back, and she was wearing silver bangle bracelets on her arm. There was an arty, casual feeling to what she wore. She stood outside her mother's apartment building, wondering which apartment she'd lived in. It was so long ago that she was sure no one who was there would remember or even know. She just liked being there, knowing that this had been her mother's neighborhood. It was a fashionable residential neighborhood called E. Parioli, and people walked by her or rode by on bicycles as scooters wove through the cars in the heavy Roman traffic and horns sounded everywhere. She stayed there for a long time and then walked away, wandered into a little church nearby, and lit a candle for her mother, grateful that their paths had somehow crossed again. She touched the locket on her neck as she thought about it, and sat peacefully in the little church, thinking about her, as old ladies came and went to say rosaries or chat quietly with friends. Several nuns were cleaning the church, and it had a welcoming atmosphere. She wondered if her mother had ever gone there, and if she had still believed in any deity after the misfortunes that had happened to her. Valerie would have understood if she didn't, and wouldn't have blamed her if not. It was a pretty neighborhood, and she felt safe there as she walked the fairly long distance back to the Piazza di Spagna, where the hotel was, and the shops on the Via Condotti nearby. It was touching discovering her mother's world and the life she had led during her half-century in Italy after she left the States. Valerie spent the rest of the day visiting small churches and had a delicious lunch of fish and pasta at a sidewalk cafe. She practiced her Italian with the waiter, and he understood her, despite her mistakes. And it amused her to notice that men looked at women in Rome of all ages. She saw several male heads turn as she walked by, and it made her smile. It could never have happened in New York, but it did here. Italian men made you feel female and desirable to the grave. And Valerie was still an attractive woman with her slim figure and still beautiful face. She walked for hours that afternoon and had dinner at a small restaurant near the hotel. She didn't like going to restaurants alone, but traveling without a companion, she had no other choice and didn't want to eat in her room, so she just did it and enjoyed the food and a strong espresso afterward before going back to the hotel. She wrote postcards that night to Philip, Winnie, and the Babcocks. Her family had grown, and the Babcocks were coming to New York for a visit in the fall to meet Philip, and had invited her to dinner in a Broadway play. She did more of the same the next day, exploring churches and galleries, admiring fountains and statues, soaking up the atmosphere of Rome, and watching the people around her. And the day after, she flew to Naples. She had several texts from Philip, asking how she was, and assured him she was fine and enjoying Rome. She took a cab from the airport to the Hotel Excelsior, where she and Lawrence had stayed years before, and watched the sights along the way. She saw Vesuvius and the Bay of Naples, and remembered taking Philip to Pompeii, and his utter amazement and fascination with it, when she explained to him what had happened there. And not wanting to drive around Naples alone and risk getting lost, she hired a car and driver at the hotel, who was available that afternoon. She had lunch on the terrace of the hotel, and went outside to meet the driver afterward, armed with her mother's address, just as Philip had done. She had Saverio Salvatore's phone numbers with her, but hadn't called him, and didn't want to disturb him if possible. She just wanted to see the chateau and bask in a private moment, thinking of her mother as a young girl of 18 with the man she loved, not long after Valerie was born. The driver explained the sights to her as they drove past them. He spoke English very well, and pointed out churches and important buildings and homes, and told her some of the history of Naples. But the history that interested her most was her own. There was a lot of traffic in the city, and it took them a while to get to the far edge of the city where the Castello was located, And when they got there, he stopped, and she got out of the car in silence, looking up with awe at what had been her mother's home. Marguerite had been a countess by then, loved by Umberto, and respected by all who knew her, according to what Saverio Salvatore had told Philip when he was there. Valerie stood at the gate for a long moment, cautiously, not wanting to intrude, but no one was there. The gates were standing wide open, and the courtyard was empty. There was a red Ferrari parked in an open garage that looked like an old stable, but the grounds were deserted. And feeling like a burglar, she walked in quietly in her sandals and jeans and the crisp white shirt she had worn on the trip with her Panama.